I begin, before I forget them, with two announcements. One is that there is an exhibit of Quaker material which you might be interested in, including some slavery material, I guess mainly slavery, in the treasure room here. It won't be there much longer, so next time you're in the library, try to take a minute and look around and see what there is there. I haven't seen it myself, so I can't say too much about it. But I hope what I'm saying on this subject falls includes some aspects of that exhibit. My other announcement, I just spoke of the slavery exhibit in the treasure room at the college library. My other announcement is that a member of the class left Law State Quakerism Notes Notebook. That wasn't found, was it? I don't think he's here.
Benham was just talking a minute ago about finding a notebook. He was asking
who was?
Professor Benham.
Oh.
I looked at it, and it had nothing to do with Quakerism.
Oh, okay, fine.
It was an electronic thing.
Well, I don't feel responsible for it, except I feel sorry for the fellow who lost it. I didn't suppose that you had, any of you had found it. As I was saying last time, the story of the relation between the Quakers and slavery is sort of the case history of a slowly evolving conscience. And for that reason, I think it's a useful illustration of even a contemporary problem. I can't help but when I look back on the past and see how people behave, saying to myself, well, I wonder whether another generation will be as critical of what we do as we are critical of what was done in the past. I don't want to make you critical of either of the slaveholders who were not friends or the slaveholders who were friends, but simply make it easy for you to recognize that there was a problem before them. And it was a difficult thing for them to see their way through. For convenience, I might try to analyze the subject as a whole historically. Beginning in 1688, for a century, American Quakers were chiefly concerned for getting rid of being involved either in the slave trade and then in holding slaves. In the same period in England, the Quakers had very little contact with slavery and did very little about it except to advise with the American yearly meetings that consulted them. And they shared the attitude of the yearly meetings in America that were becoming anxious and nervous about their implication. In this period, the motive was not so much concern for the slave as concern for the Quaker who owned the slave or traded the slave. When I talk like this about Quakerism, people say it's a very selfish religion. Doesn't care about anybody but the Quaker himself. His desire to be innocent is prevailing. Well, in a certain sense, that's true. It may be a selfishness that has a useful social byproducts. Or it may be a refined kind of selfishness. After all, there are more or less refined kinds of selfishness, and this may be a refined kind. At any rate, this criticism could be made. And I don't want to play down that that was really what bothered the Quaker. They found themselves doing something they thought they ought not to be doing. It made them uncomfortable, and they made other people uncomfortable. As you read John Woolman's journal, you discover that he's a very uncomfortable people for slave owners to deal with. The next period in America was a period of trying to influence other people. These overlap a bit, but trying to influence other people, especially in America, against slave owning. But until the Friends themselves were free of it, they didn't talk too much to other people. As long as they had their own members that weren't innocent in this matter, they couldn't present a useful front. They weren't the kind of people that said, we think slave owning is wrong, but we keep on doing it. There are a lot of people that behave that way. They don't like to put it that way, but that's what they do. We know it's wrong, but what can you do? Working with non-friends then was a long chapter in American Quakerism, lasting down through the Civil War, and involved them in a great many problems. Now, going to England, about the end of the 18th century, in the 1780s, the English Friends began trying to bring pressure to bear on Great Britain's government, which was responsible largely for the slave trade. The East India Company had a monopoly of it, was under royal patronage, and many of the influential merchants in the trade were English merchants, and therefore, although there were many Quakers involved, they began thinking they owed it to the cause to do something about it. And they began petitioning Parliament. And that lasted for a long time until finally in 1808, a law was passed abolishing the slave trade in the British Dominions. They kept on working on it, now with the help of other people, not friends, and there was a campaign to end slavery entirely, which ended, as you remember, about 1833. Well, that's the general division, and I had spoken last time of some of the earlier motives, and we looked at the Germantown petition. One of the motives that occurs at least in one important book which you're reading, it's John Woolman's Journal, is this attitude. This is a characteristic old-fashioned religious attitude, that if we do what's wrong and continue doing what's wrong, God will punish us. And in 1758, when Woolman was talking to Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, he said something like this: "Many slaves on this continent are oppressed, and their cries have reached the ears of the Most High God. Such are the purity and certainty of his judgments, God's judgments, that he cannot be partial in our favor over against the slaves. In infinite love and goodness, he has opened our understanding from time to time respecting our duty toward this people, and is not a time for delay. Should we now be aware of what he requires of us, and through a respect to the private interest of some persons, or through a regard to some friendships which do not stand on the immutable foundation, neglect to do our duty in firmness and constancy, still waiting for some extraordinary means to bring about their freedom, God may, by terrible things and righteousness, answer us in this matter." Do I need to translate that into English? Perhaps I do. If we know what's right and don't do it, and delay doing what's right because we are considerate of other people whom we admire and respect, but who continue to own slaves, or because we're hoping that the whole thing will end in some other way, and not by our participation against it, we have no excuse. And God may very likely bring some disaster upon us if we don't do that.
There's no foundation for this, though, in the, I mean, opposed from, I mean, other than the Old Testament, say, there's no foundation for the fact that God sends destruction to people that don't do good.
Now, this, of course, is the old-fashioned Old Testament. Yeah, perhaps I shouldn't call it old-fashioned. The Old Testament view that if men do wrong and persist in doing God, God finally brings disaster upon them. Is that what you mean by?
Well, I was wondering whether how much of this is a Quaker attempt to intimidate themselves as well as others.
Yes.
Into doing what they thought was right.
Well, if the Quaker thought he was right and the other man was wrong, it's to the interest of the other man for him to tell himself, isn't it? Isn't it?
Right.
Yes? If he's right about it, I mean, the Quaker's right about it. I think I pointed out when the Quakers kept pouring into Massachusetts, perhaps that's a little strong term, but coming back to Massachusetts, because the people there were not allowing freedom of religion, one of their motives was that they thought that God required freedom of religion, and that the people of Massachusetts were running a very grave risk in the sight of God and at the hands of God if they didn't do something about it. Now, of course, this is a case of translating your own preference into divine will, which is something that people do, but it's also it's logical, and taking the premise, it's logical to say that we owe it to the people of Massachusetts to warn them. If they don't abolish what they call the bloody laws, that is, the penal laws against the Quakers, something will happen. And as you know, the Quakers were pretty quick to see when a divine judgment did befall a persecutor, weren't they? We run into that. So the whole history of early Massachusetts is a history of Quakers pointing out disasters. The King Philip's War was one of the first and most evident. And Quakers, when it came, told the people of New England, this is God's punishment for the way you treat the Quakers. And you know what the ministers, the Orthodox ministers, the church in Massachusetts said? They said, this is God's judgment upon us, because we allow the Quakers even to live in our country. This is, well, they and their opponents both had this same theology of divine punishment. They both inherited from the biblical religion. Well, I just read that passage from Woolman showing that, and I expect there were people that said that the bloodshed of the Revolutionary War was divine judgment upon the slave-owning people of North America. And there are other people that said later, at the time of the Civil War, that disaster was divine judgment upon the country for tolerating slave-owning, at least in part of it. But the Quakers were pretty relentless when they once got this notion in their head. They were pretty stubborn people. And when they got this notion, and they were stubborn also for far as they themselves were concerned. It's very dangerous to get a conscientious scruple and try to live by it, because it'll carry you further than you anticipate. And that's shown by the steps. It was obvious that bringing in slaves was stealing them, kidnapping them, and that it was unjust. But if you're going to object the slave trade importing them, what about the domestic trade? Doesn't that follow? Isn't that stolen goods? And so a sensitive conscience But all I'm saying, a sensitive conscience, well, I just warn you against it, if you're not ready to take the consequences. It carries you further than you first intend, or more than you first see.